So as we get started today, before we get into all of the lesson in that, very quickly, we're going to be getting into God's directed design for the tabernacle. And this is the new cover for the book, but a lot of my resource information that I'll be bringing into the class is going to be coming out of this book. By no means am I going to bring you all of the good quality and quantity of this book. It's called The Tabernacle, Shadows of the Messiah. It's Sacrifices, Services, and Priesthood. Three different subtitles there, but it's by David Levy, L-E-V-Y. So if you want the full meal, you can pick yourself up a copy of Mr. Levy's book. If not, well then you can follow along for the pieces I can manage to absorb and bring to this class. But when we get into the tabernacle, God is very explicit. And there is something that I almost crave for the people of that era that they couldn't and didn't have. And that's the book of Hebrews. Because in the book of Hebrews, you find out so much more about what that tabernacle was and its relationship to Jesus' ongoing ministry today in heaven in the heavenly tabernacle. So we'll bring some of that across. I can't stop and deviate and do Hebrews in the way it would deserve, but we'll do portions of the book of Hebrews along with that as well, so that we get the chance to make that linkage that should be made, and it needs to be made. So with that, let's get on to our content for today. We're going to be looking at Exodus chapter 19. Last time in chapter 18, it was all about the interaction with Jethro. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. At some time, Moses apparently had sent his wife Zipporah and his two sons, Gershom and Eleazar, to be with Jethro while Moses was involved with the other activities. We don't know exactly where that happened in the events, but they've come now to the near to the mountain of God, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, and Jethro hears that Moses is there, and so he also had heard how the Lord had brought, Lord, and that's Jehovah there, had brought Israel out of Egypt, and so he came near to Moses, sent word to Moses, and they met up. They had a very affectionate greeting. Moses recounted the events of the Lord's role in taking care of them. And Jethro, who was the priest of Midian, likely not a priest that was devoted wholly to Jehovah, but Jethro breaks out in testimony. Now I know that Jehovah is greater than all the gods. He says it is proven when the gods were arrogantly opposed to the people, because it was out of the gods that you can see Jehovah pushing back and attacking those gods fairly directly in the events that he chose to use as the plagues and so on. And Jethro goes on, blessed be the Lord who delivered you. And he stops and he offers a burnt offering in worship to God. And then following that, he sits down with Aaron and the elders of Israel for a meal that is devoted to God. So they're worshiping together in somewhat of a feast there. And then the last of the chapter, Jethro observes Moses acting as a judge over the people. And he saw long lines. He saw it take a long day. He saw a weary Moses. And by implication, we know he saw weary people. And so Jethro calls out Moses and says, what are you doing? This isn't working well. Moses has an answer and says, well, I'm asked to judge and teach the laws of the people. And so Jethro says, well, keep on teaching the law, right, the good thing to do, but appoint able, God-fearing men, honest haters of dishonest gain, to be judges over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. And he says, do this with the Lord's direction, and then they can bring their claims up through the chain, and if some of those are significant enough, they will find their way for you to settle, but the majority can be handled by these judges. And so Moses implements that, and at that point Jethro leaves and goes back to Midian, to his own home, and Moses' family is reunited. Any questions or comments over yesterday? That was very brief, high points. Okay, well today, I say yesterday, last time would be a more accurate description. So today we're going to look at chapter 19. We'll see how far we get. And the first round will be verses 1 through 8. So let me read those for you. Now the two angels, whoops, that's Genesis. Let's turn some more words, more pages here. All right. In the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." So Moses came and called to the elders of the people, and set before them all of the words which the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud, so that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. All right, I said through 8, I went through 9. But it's the third month after leaving Egypt, and it says, on that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And that word Sinai means thorny, and it's believed that the mountain at that time, and probably yet today, has many thorny bushes on it. And of course, what day are we talking about? Well, if we go over to Exodus 12, 18, we can look there. Let's do that. Exodus 12, 18. This gives us the starting point for what we're talking about. And we're in Exodus 12, we're talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Passover meal and those things. And in the discussion where they're talking about eating the meal, it says, "In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening." And so this is the night before they leave Israel. So they leave on the 15th of the month, the next morning after that meal. If we turn just a few pages over to chapter 16, in verse 1, we get another milestone along their path. And it says in verse 1 of chapter 16, "Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from Egypt." So the 15th day of the second month after their departure, well, they left on the 15th, and now that's the 15th of the second month, not 2 months later, but month two of the year, and so there's they've got about a 30-day period in that trip. And from there, they cross the Red Sea, and they spend 3 days after their crossing wishing they had water, and we get all of that. They've come to Marah, and it's a bitter water, and Moses is directed to a branch that he throws in, and they get sweet water. And from there they go to Elim, and that's what we see here. And they have 12 springs and 70 date palms. So it's after the crossing plus this to Elim, and that's where the 30 days is. I said that wrong just a moment ago. And so it's been 30 days, and then they go to the wilderness of Sinai, and wilderness of sin, I'm sorry. And in that trip through the wilderness of sin, we see the introduction of manna, the meat, the Sabbath worship, and other rules, the law. And this is all set up. The rules are there. God says, I'm going to test the people. I'm going to give them the rules and see if they do that. So they left on the 15th day of the first month. And the 15th day of the second month, they were at Elim. And now we're in the third month. And there's a Jewish idiom involved here. I went a different direction in my own thinking for a while, but as I continued to read and look at what commentaries and so on, that phrase, on that very day, is an idiom for on the first day of the month. So if we talk about on that very day of the month, it's the first day of the month. So here they are, we're about 45 days. On the first day of the third month, they enter the area of Sinai, the desert of Sinai, and probably 13 to 15 days or so after entering the wilderness of sin, then they enter Sinai and you get to the mountain of God. I need to turn back to that very quickly. And so they're now in the wilderness of Sinai, and in verse 2, we get a little bit of a summary that when they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. So now we're at Mount Sinai in the general area of it, and that'll become very clear as we go on. Barb, can I ask you to do that? That's right back there. And so here they are at the mountain. And what's significant about them being at Mount Sinai? What prophecy can you select up, hook up with this? You remember?
When Moses was sent to Egypt, he saw the burning bush on Mount Sinai, and God told him that he would be bringing the people back to this mountain to worship him.
Look at Exodus 3:12. That is exactly right. Exodus 3:12. And by the way, Moses has not accepted the role yet. This is in the middle, really the early part, of the argument between God and Moses about Moses going to do this task. And Moses does a lot of arguing with God, and God is having none of it, although he was very patient, and he gave him some things to use to help him out. But in verse 12 it says, and he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. That was a prophecy given to Moses for Moses' benefit, and as a sign to him to be sure of what he was doing. Now it's interesting, when I think about it in my own mind, that there's a lot of events where Moses was totally dependent on God that you could say these were the things that God was showing him. But let's recognize one thing about it, and that is, how were they led to where they are right now? Did Moses do it? Did Moses say, okay, now go here, now go there? How were they led? Pillar of cloud, pillar of fire. So here God has brought them through this journey right to where he told them he would bring them. It's a sign for you, Moses, that along the journey, I'm going to bring you right back to this mountain, and the whole nation of Israel will be worshiping at this mountain. And so here they are at the mountain. And in verse 3, it says, Moses went up to God. So I'm assuming he went in the area of the pillars. And the Lord called to him from the mountain. And he gives him some instructions to the people. And he says, tell this to the sons of Israel. Now, that's an interesting way that that verse is worded. Here's what God says. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel. So who is Moses supposed to talk to?
Moses is the mediator between God and the people of Israel.
Well, Moses is that mediator, certainly, but who has God sent him to? This isn't a hard question.
The children of Israel.
People of Israel.
The people of Israel, but...
The leaders, there are tribal leaders.
There's two names used here.
House of Jacob.
House of Jacob, sons of Israel. Why the two names? It's the same people with two different labels put on top of them, right? Who lived personally his life with these two names?
Jacob
and Israel. I mean, we're going to have to say his names to answer the question. When did Jacob's name change to Israel?
After he wrestled with God.
And I think there's a little bit of a message in the names that God is using with Moses here. Okay, we've been dragging Jacob across the countryside. Jacob, is Jacob the kind of guy you would like to go in business with? Probably not if you knew his history. Is he the son that you would wish to have? Well, talk to his dad, Isaac, and Isaac would have said, no, I'm mad at this guy. Is he the brother that you'd like to have? Well, Esau sure didn't think so. Jacob was kind of an interesting guy. His mom more so than him, but he followed his mom in being conniving and getting things done the way he thought they needed to be through deception and other means. To the point that, why did Jacob leave home?
Esau wanted to kill him.
Esau wanted him dead. Was Esau a messenger of God? Well, God used him, but Esau was not a person that God said, you know, you're going to be my spokesman for something. Matter of fact, if we look at the scriptures, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. But nonetheless, he had made Esau so upset, and Dad wasn't real thrilled at that point either, but Jacob takes off, and he goes to his mother's family, and there he gets in a little different kind of a situation and winds up finding a woman that he wants for his wife, and of course, we know how that goes. She had a sister, and his father-in-law was as good at subterfuge as he was, at least somewhat good. And so then he spends a lot of years there, and God blesses him with big herds, partly through some miraculous things that God does as a result of Jacob following what he's shown to do in some dreams. But then on the way back, there's this wrestling match. And it's at that point that Jacob is confronted with the God of his fathers. And this God and he wrestle, and Jacob is determined to stay attached to that God. He did not want to let God go. And he was injured in the hip, and it never got better. And so he limped the rest of his life, but God indeed blessed him and said, now your name will be Israel. And so that's when Jacob really begins to be more, I mean, he was following God when he was with his father-in-law, but this is a time when it's a moment where things change in terms of Israel's relationship, Jacob's relationship with God. And so in this, we're emphasizing both aspects of who Jacob was. Jacob the scoundrel, who followed God some, to Jacob the one that wrestled with God and wanted God to be a part of his life. And so tell the house of Jacob, the sons of Israel. And in verse 4 he says, tell them, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians. We would say in our vernacular, you've seen with your own eyes. You were there. You saw what I did to the Egyptians. What did he do to the Egyptians? You saw the plagues. You saw the plunder that you were given. You saw their desire to see you gone. You saw the Red Sea parted. You saw the destruction of all of the Egyptian army. And you saw how I bore you on eagle's wings to myself. What does that mean? What did he do there? Were they literally flown on the backs of eagles? No. So what's he talking about? I bore you on eagle's wings to myself.
It's just an expression for miraculous deliverance.
Yeah, I got you here in ways that defied what you would normally expect. You were able to make the path, pillar of fire and pillar of cloud for both vision and direction, food, water. I moved you through the desert probably at a miraculous speed. We're not given enough data to know if that really was for sure part of it, but most likely. And so they had travel, food, water, all of these things. When they were going through all of these things, would they have said, oh yes, look at how God is taking us through like we're on wings of eagles? Would they have said that? What did they say over and over again? Why did you bring us out here to die? God is giving them the perspective that they ought to be putting on their trip to Mount Sinai. I bore you like you were on eagle's wings. And if they looked back with any kind of insight and honesty, they would have to agree. Even to the point of the fact that they were packing all this gold and valuable items from Egypt, let alone that they were out from under slavery. I mean, God has given them a massive blessing in his leading of them to Mount Sinai. And so he said, you saw it with your own eyes. You ought to figure this out. You ought to get it by now, is what God is saying to them. And then he goes on in verse 5, with this clearly in mind, now then, so thinking about that, now then, pay attention. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my own possession among all the peoples as priests for my kingdom, for all the earth is mine. The kingdom of priests actually comes in verse 6. But God is saying, if. This is not a, I'm going to do this. Count on it. No, he starts with an if. It's going to hinge upon their obedience to what God will tell them to do. God hasn't laid out everything for them. God is saying, if you obey my voice, so he's going to keep talking, keep giving direction. And it says, indeed obey, meaning truthfully and absolutely, and keep my covenant agreement. This is part of the if-then statement. Then you will be my possession among all the peoples. All the earth is mine, but you're going to be my possession. Well, he possesses it all, but you're going to be the special possession. And it's going to be clear that you are mine. Is this attractive to the people? Do you think, to hear this? Well, let's go on. We'll find out. And of course, in verse 6, God is not done. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Priests are going to speak on behalf of God. They're going to be testifiers about Jehovah and who he is. And a holy nation, meaning good and righteous, set apart. And of course, what does he call that? You will be a kingdom of priests. What does that word kingdom mean? If you have a kingdom, what must you have to have a kingdom? A king. Who's going to be king here? God himself. There's not an earthly king. You're going to be a people that follows God with him as their king. So that's the offer that's made to them, or going to be made. This is the instructions that God is giving to him on what to say. By the way, how have the people done so far in obeying God's voice? Not so good. They either en masse complain about the path that they're on and what's happening and say, why did you bring us here to die? Or groups of them are rebelling. Oh, let's just take some extra manna and save a little till tomorrow, which got Moses really upset. And things like that. Oh, we'll go out on the seventh day and try to collect a little more. No, it's not going to work that way. So what Moses did in verse 7 is he called for the elders of the people. He told them the words just as God had directed him. And what do the people do in verse 8? With one voice, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. So do you think it was attractive to them? Did it look like a good opportunity that they wanted to take part in? Yeah.
Didn't hear the if.
Well, what do you suppose? You know, let's go on. We'll get to the end of this, end of verse 10, then we'll talk for a minute. Actually, we're just going to stop here with verse 8. I'll pick up and start with verse 9 through the rest of the chapter. But when Moses tells the people this, they quickly want to do it. We know enough history of the Old Testament. How are they going to do with that? Not very well. Are they even going to make it a few days? No. What's going to be the next big event that shows that they don't really, can't really, won't really do this? The golden calf is just around the corner. We've all had the kid stories that they teach in Sunday school enough. They're not kid stories, but the simplified accounts to know what's coming. So why would they be so enthusiastic now? What's missing that keeps them from realizing what they're saying yes to?
Did they hear what they wanted to hear?
That's a pretty good way of putting it. When we think about things that we read in the scriptures, what kind of a mental picture do we take? When we look at Matthew chapter 6, and Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and he's just gone through all the things that people need, that they worry about having, and he says, and all these things will be added to you. What kind of a mental picture do we make? It's going to be wonderful. I mean, there are whole segments of Christendom that have a health and wealth expectation from God. Is that the way it works? It might. God might make you. I mean, there were some pretty good times for Abraham. There might be some pretty good times for you. You may go through periods of time when every just thing just seems to be working out wonderful. But is that God's point here, and is that what God really is trying to accomplish? Because for them to act as priests, the message that God sends to this world is not, follow me and be rich. Matter of fact, when Jesus comes and clarifies the message, what does he say? If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself. What's next? Take up his cross and follow me. Now, if we look at that, he said that to the disciples, to the apostles in particular. Do you think they thought that would be a good path to take? Well, sure they did. They wanted to follow Christ. They were hearing what he said. Their hearts were thrilled with the way that he taught and what he taught. They were getting a lot of it. And yet, what happened when Jesus was arrested? They scattered. Did they deny themselves, take up their crosses, and follow him? What does it mean to deny yourself? Sounds simple enough.
Die to self.
Die to self.
You're no longer first. Christ is, or God is first.
I would even say that just a little bit differently, and I'll do it in a minute with another verse. But yeah, God's first. It's not. It's no longer you who set the primary priorities of your life. You're going to actually set aside the priorities of your life. Some of you here, I know, have memorized Romans 9 and 10. Romans 9, what does Romans, I'm sorry, Romans, Romans 10, 9 and 10. What does verse 9 of Romans 10, 9 and 10 say? You remember? That if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That first phrase is more explicit than we often think it is. What does it mean to say, believe out of your heart, Jesus is Lord? What does that word Lord mean?
He's above all.
Okay. That word Lord means master. That was a common word used all over the culture that Jesus was in and that Paul was a part of and that Paul would be thinking about when he wrote those verses. That word means master, and it means master in a context. And the context of the word master there is if you have a master, then you are a slave. It's not Jesus is the chief advisor to the corporation of my life. No, Jesus is master of every detail of my life. Slaves consistently were expected 100% to deny themselves. Their wishes and wants and dreams and ideas didn't matter one bit about anything. They might have a kind master that would take into account some of the parts of that slave's life, but by and large, slaves didn't have dreams and wishes and things like that to follow after. They had one role in life, and that was to do what the master said at every turn for every reason. And so that's what it means to say Jesus is Lord. And so when God is talking to us through Christ, and we think about being a Christian, there's much more to setting aside ourselves than we sometimes think. Our vision for what it means is God's going to come along and be a part of my life, and as I serve him, I can expect some good things to happen. And you know what? That's not wrong. I want to give you the other side of that. Hebrews 11, 6. I think I got the right verse. I better look. Hebrews 11, 6. Yes. Because this is important to understand about what it means to be a slave of God. Because slaves were rewarded from time to time, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. And then we start getting all the examples of faith. So how do we put that together? Well, it's really quite simple. When we're born again, we do, through the grace of God, have started the process of denying ourselves. There's probably a lot of opportunities to come up in life to deny ourselves that we didn't anticipate. But we're a new creature. And that new creature has been born again, has been purchased with a price to serve Jesus Christ. And that our hearts, through the time of sanctification, through teaching, as we're taught to observe everything that Jesus had commanded, as we are taught to pray like Christ taught the disciples to pray, as we're taught to interact, there is a relationship involved there we are not just slaves, but we also then are in the process of being sons and being adopted into Christ, and all that's there, but still at the root of it all, it starts with being a slave to Christ, setting aside who we are. The things that we want fade away. How can you want a steak when you compare it to eternal life? I mean, the comparison between what it means to be in the household of God as a son, as a child, is so much more than we could ever have living out the best life in this world. And so it's not about being successful in this world. Our lives turn, our desires turn to what Christ would have. Those very things that at one time we pursued in sin because they seemed to give pleasure now become things that we hate. We see them as distractions, as things that move us away from God. And so we get a chance to look at all that. We get to realize Paul's own words, "I am convinced it is Christ, who is God, who is at work in you, both to will," that's who we are, what we want, "and to work," that's the labors we put into, so we can be happy? No, for his good pleasure. But pleasing God becomes our goal. What these people probably didn't realize, maybe not even Moses, I don't know, but what they weren't thinking about was what it would mean to become a holy nation, what it would mean to be priests of God. And so God told Moses what to say. God said it to the people. They immediately respond with, "Oh, we're going to do that." But they weren't really ready to do that at all. And then in verse 9, I'm going to go ahead and cover that. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm going to come unto you in a thick cloud so that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. So God is establishing a time when they're going to hear me speak with you. And out of that, they will know that you are my servant forever. He says, "believe in you," but what they're going to believe in is that God was speaking through Moses as he interacted with them. Questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Rick, that in verse 6, Moses says, "You shall be to be a king and a priest in a holy nation." Peter quotes that very verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, God's not done with this concept, even though these people don't do so well for a long time. I mean, there are times, I don't want to paint it as just a black picture. There are times Israel did well for God. Unfortunately, those times are too far and few between, and too small of a part of Israel generally is participating in those good times. But there are some good times. There's the time that they're going to be marching around Jericho and see the city fall. So, I mean, it's not zero, but it's pretty limited. And the history is, I mean, just read Judges, read the Chronicles and the Kings, and it's just pretty limited on how well they did. Good. Thanks, David. Anything else? Well, let's start with verse 10 and read through 17. The Lord also said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for all the people all around, saying, Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, then they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman." So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning, flashes, and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So God has called Moses up on the mountain, and in the course of that interaction, Moses has told them, told God what the people said, and now God says to Moses, go down to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments. So he's saying, get ready. They can't come into the presence of God with nonchalance. They've got to do this as a people who have been consecrated. And so I don't know what was all involved in the consecration, except that a piece of it is wash their garments. Be ready on the third day, in verse 11. On that day, the Lord will come down to Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And he says, and they will see the Lord. And that's an interesting statement, because we see through scriptures talking about seeing the Lord. First of all, they see the Lord in the columns, right? In the fire and in the cloud. There's lots of seeing the Lord, but they're not equal events. Because later on in this chapter, in this book, we're going to see Moses say, you know, he's there on the mountain with God. The people here are going to see God, so to speak, but what it means for them to see God isn't the same thing Moses asked for. I want to see you. And what Moses is asking for there, God says, no, you can't. You can't look upon the Lord and live. And so we just have to realize there's some context here we have to put into it. They're going to recognize, and they're going to have visual information that tells them God's on that mountain. They're going to know they're in the presence of God. They're going to see the effects of God being there. It doesn't mean that they're going to see God like Moses asked for later on in the events that we'll be seeing. So they're not all equal sightings. In verse 12, God tells Moses, now set boundaries for the people all around. This is a comprehensive statement. Tell them, beware, be careful not to go up on the mountain or to touch its border. Whoever touches the mountain will be put to death. In verse 13, he's going to explain that death penalty, but let's talk about that a minute. How do you set boundaries? We don't know what they did, but there were some sort of markers put out, something that said, here is the line. You don't go beyond this line. You don't touch anything beyond that line. This is showing the holiness of God and their lack of holiness. So tell them to be careful. Don't go up on the mountain or touch its border. And if they do, they're to be put to death. Verse 13 explains the death penalty. If somebody does, don't touch that person with hands. Don't lay your hands on them. Apparently, I think it's fair to say, don't become contaminated with them. They're to be stoned or shot through. Now, I don't know what shot through means, but clearly it's a lethal form of injury. You know, it sounds like they're going to pull out the .357 and shoot him, right? If we were in a different area, they talked in the pirating days, on the shipboard days, about running somebody through. That meant the sword was taken out and they were skewered. I don't know what this means, but we know what stoning is. So in some fashion, you're going to put this person to death without touching them. It's not that God's going to put them to death. God leaves it in their hands to keep themselves clean and set apart from the unholiness, from the contamination of this person. So if somebody does that, man or beast. So they had to keep up with their herdsmanship work during this time. And it's going to happen on the third day when you hear a long ram's horn blast. And at that point, Moses, bring the people up. And so clearly their camp was not on the mountain. It was some distance away, but right next to it. And imagine for a moment, if you will, can you put this in your mind's eye? We believe that it's likely they had a million plus, or at least nearly a million. Moses somehow has to get the camp up to this boundary area that's been put up and have them be there to witness what God's going to do. And then we get down into verses 10 through 13. God continues to give Moses instruction. Now go down to the people. So this is the end of the first trip up to the mountain, and wash their garments and be ready on the third day. And he adds that, don't go near a woman. And I think what he's saying there is, this is a time of consecration. Set yourself apart. For the next 3 days, your focus is meeting with God. Be working on your consecration. Be working on getting cleaned up. You're going to be in the presence of God. Get ready. And so that's the focus. And then in verse 16, on day 3 in the morning, and as much as you can, Cecil B. DeMille probably would help you if you've seen some of his shows. There's thunder. There's lightning. There's a thick cloud. And out of that time when these things are going on, these all look like what could be natural events at that point, but the trumpet sounds. And it's very loud. Who blew the trumpet? I don't know if there was a trumpet that was blown exactly, but God provided the sound of a ram's horn. And all in the people in the camp trembled. So they haven't left the camp yet, but they're in camp, and all this is going on. And what does it mean they trembled, do you think? What is that signifying?
It's probably so loud it scared them to death.
Exactly. Great fear. This is more than they counted on back when we had the "if you will do my things" statement. Right now, they're recognizing the power that's going on that hill, on the mountain, and they are taken in by it. And if it weren't for the trumpet or the ram's horn, you might be sitting there going, "Wow, never seen a storm like this." But when you hear a horn in the middle of the storm, and it said it was very loud, wouldn't it have to be very loud? You've been in thunderstorms, you know, outside. You're to hear this and for everybody to hear it, they're scared. And you know what? That's a great response. The fear of the Lord is
beginning
of wisdom. They lacked fear of God. They have been brazenly in your face to God through Moses most of the time. Why'd you bring us out here to die? Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? Oh, now we and all of our animals are going to die of thirst. It would be better if we had been killed with the Egyptians than to be out here by the Red Sea. These people have been brazenly arrogant to God. They didn't understand who he was and what kind of a response God deserved. And so, in the midst of their trembling, in verse 17, Moses brings the people from the camp to meet God. And they stand at the foot of the mountain. And so now we're ready to see more events begin to occur on Mount Sinai, but I would be foolish to start into that next section and think I would get it done in 7 minutes. But I do want to bring something to our thoughts and feeling, and I'm convicted by this often. Our approach to God. You know, what setting should we be in to pray to God?
Don't have to be in any kind of setting.
That's true. Is there a particular way that we should be dressed to pray to God? No. But there's something here we ought not miss. And that is, if we think we're going into, as we were told, to go boldly into the throne room of God because Jesus had made the way for us, our prayers can be taken to God. He's a loving Father, doesn't mean He's still not God. And I'm convicted often about how I approach God. I'll be praying and think, what am I doing? Sitting here, I'm so nonchalant about this. I need, and often in recent days, I have stopped and said, I'm going to go clean up, get ready for the day. I'm going to be in a better setting. I'm not going to approach God like He's just a messenger service to take down my message from my thoughts today. I'm going to stop and give Him a little more reverence, a little more majesty. And I'm not saying I'm right in that when you pray in the midst of your day, I mean, the scriptures tell us to pray without ceasing. There's an attitude of prayer we should have that in whatever's going on, we can pray to God. And I'm not saying we can't or we shouldn't, but I'm saying there's times when we ought to say, God, you know, I'm going to recognize who You are by how I conduct myself in the next half hour as I come to meet with You over prayer. It's awfully easy in the modern world to become very nonchalant with God. And I'll tell you one of the outcomes of that that I really am convinced has occurred. You talk to somebody about God as judge, as God who brings judgment, as God, you know, after death, it's appointed for man once to die, and after that comes judgment, and people go, oh, no, no, that's not my God. We become not so nonchalant, we don't have to figure out who God is, we can just decide who He is. Does that make sense? There's a certain amount of recognizing just who God is that we need to do as we live out our Christian lives. And we need His perspective on what that looks like and what it means to have that kind of a reverence. At the same time, when Jesus said to pray to the Father and so on, you know, our Father in heaven, just calling Him Father, our Father, was a big step in His time. To the point, at one point, He says, so we cry, Abba, Father. So that's a very familiar, by that I mean family term, like we would say Daddy. And so, yes, we have that kind of a relationship with God, but it doesn't change who God is. And so we need to have the fullness of our understanding of who God is, even as we go, Abba, Father. Hey, man, I'm in a bind here, Lord. I'm really upset. Can You please provide some direction for me and some understanding of truth so I can move through this? Does that make sense? Of recognizing just who God is as we live out our lives. Well, that's what I have for this morning. We'll pick it up with verse 18 next.